I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Last weekend, on the eve of the 4th of July, some 200 members of the Patriot Front, a white nationalist hate group, marched through the streets of Philadelphia carrying American flags, flags displaying their logo, and signs that read, "Reclaim America," chanting, "The election was stolen." They were met by city residents shouting at the group and eventually forcing them down to Penn's Landing, where they got in their rental trucks and left town. There were no arrests. Our guest is Abdul Ali Muhammad. They are a Philadelphia-based activist and writer who documented the Patriot Front marching in Center City on Saturday and was one of several targets of violence and retaliation. Abdul Ali Muhammad, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Did you know this white supremacist group was coming to Philadelphia last weekend?
I had no idea that they would be here on Saturday. I had no clue.
So how did you find out?
I was heading back home, honestly, from dinner. And a friend and I had gone out to eat, and we were driving up Ben Franklin Parkway. And I noticed them assemble by the Holocaust Memorial. They were gathering back together at the Holocaust Memorial. And I told that friend to pull over so that I can get out and capture what was happening, because at the time, no police were, as you know, following them or trailing them. And there was no news agency present at that moment.
I have watched some of your video. For our listeners, describe what you saw. I said about 200 people. I've read various accounts. Does that seem about right?
That seems about right. Yeah, it was about 200 white men with khaki pants. They all had the same shirt on, or a variation of the same shirt that was, I think, black, and it read "Reclaim America" with different logos on it. They all had boots on, like combat boots. They all had, most of them had caps on, like baseball, I guess baseball caps. And they all, most of them had these very hard tactical defense shields that were clear and hard plastic, it seemed like. And they all had white masks on, covering their face up to their eyes so that you couldn't see them. And some of them had flags, which had upside down American, like an upside down American flag. Some of them had the flag of the Patriot Front. And they you know, marched and chanted and threw smoke bombs and hit people, and had a drone with a camera on it, had a photographer and a videographer as well.
To document, obviously, what was going on from their perspective. Did you know, last Saturday, before this happened, did you know the Patriot Front? Had you ever heard of them?
I had never heard of the Patriot Front, but I recall reading about their leader, Rousseau, who was a part of the Charlottesville white supremacist attack. And so, you know, afterwards, I found out that, you know, he was the leader of this new formation, it seems like. So I didn't know about Patriot Front necessarily, but I knew that they were white supremacists when I saw them.
You followed them with your video. I mean, everyone's got a camera now, right, with their cell phones. So you followed them. Again, describe to our listeners what you saw, what they did, where they went.
Yeah, so I followed them from Ben Franklin Parkway down to Dilworth Plaza, where they kind of marched around City Hall. At that point, other people started noticing them and started engaging with them and telling them to leave. They started arguing with one person. They threw a smoke bomb, and under the cover of the smoke bomb, they started fighting this person. And so that's when I had to join in and kind of help defend this person from them hitting him. And they beat him up a little bit. And he defended himself. And then I helped out. And then other people joined in when they noticed that they were throwing, deploying smoke bombs and hitting people.
And was he badly? Was he badly hurt?
I think he was definitely hurt. I don't know his condition. I do know that they hit him pretty badly with the shields, with fists, with kicking. And then we kind of put, get them off of him. And then they continue to march around City Hall. And then they go down, they go around to Market Street. And then they go down Market. And then more people joined us when we were around the Wawa. And then again, a fight breaks out because other folks are there and they start engaging with them. And there's some more fighting. And then they kind of continue marching down to the Constitution Center. And at that point, they kind of march through Old City over to, I want to say, Walnut Street.
Sure.
And then they go down Walnut until they go, get to the bridge that takes you over to Penn's Landing, or takes you over. And then there's a parking lot over by Columbus Boulevard where they had three Penske, yellow Penske trucks waiting for them, where they tried to like scurry off. And I was trying to get their license plates and like their faces. And then another fight breaks out because they were trying to like push and shove and attack me and others from capturing their identity and also the license plates for the car, for the trucks. And they pulled a person onto the truck who was one of the counter protesters.
And where were the police?
The police were standing there. They were just standing there, not doing anything, honestly. I guess when folks were screaming that they had somebody on the trucks, the cops did nothing. The trucks left the parking lot, and then sometime later is when you start hearing sirens of police cars trying to go find them, but they were honestly with them the entire time, and they didn't pursue them until after they left the parking lot, when folks were saying that they potentially have someone on the truck. And I think that that is what triggered the police doing something about it.
I saw a quote from actually a police officer there that was this was probably down at Penn's Landing, saying literally this group was ran they literally ran away from the people of Philadelphia. Was that your experience that people like yourselves and others who were counter protesters essentially ran this group out of town?
I think the was I think what happened was twofold. I think that they were trying to make a propaganda video. And so when they weren't visible to people, they were doing violent acts. And then when the smoke bombs would dissipate, they would pretend like they were people just practicing their First Amendment right. So they were very tactical in the way that they were intending to be perceived by the cops, I'm guessing. And I do think that they didn't know what was coming next from us. And so they did have to scurry off and leave. So I do think that that is somewhat true that we ran them away, and that they understood that they couldn't just assemble freely and march through the streets of Philadelphia without resistance. And I think also that they were trying to capture them being docile for the cameras to recruit people.
Were you hurt at all?
Yes, they banged up my leg pretty badly with one of those heavy shields. My back was really like just hurting and throbbing from pain for the past few days. I've been icing and using medicine to help with that.
And how many people, and we're talking about here Philadelphia residents, not the members of the Patriot Front, how many people, as you followed this group, were on the street shouting at them? And again, I've seen a lot of this video. There were pretty vocal protests against Patriot Front from Philadelphia
Yeah,
residents. Yeah, go
yeah.
ahead.
It was no more than 15. There was no more than 15
Just very
people.
loud.
Yeah, just very loud. But no more than 15 of us, honestly. And I was very, it was sparse at the beginning, like probably six. But I think at the height, it was about 15 folks who were engaged with them from Philly.
And I know that this group actually had defaced a George Floyd mural up in North Philadelphia, apparently was defaced by Patriot Front. Do you know anything about that?
I do recall that mural being defaced, and it makes sense that it was them that did it. And, you know, we can't tolerate white supremacists parading through Philadelphia, defacing the mural of George Floyd, who was murdered by police. Like, we cannot tolerate that in Philly. And, you know, the mayor, you know, said he was disgusted, but it's like, what are you actually doing to prevent white supremacists from freely assembling and speaking hate and violence on to marginalized people in the city?
Were they meaning the Patriot Front, were they chanting racist and anti-Semitic chants?
Yeah. I mean, they were saying Reclaim America, and they were saying that the election was stolen. And when you go on their website and you read their manifesto, they essentially say that they believe in a European diaspora, and that if you're not of European stock, then you can't be an American citizen. So that's what they say on their own manifesto. And then they talk about dutiful citizens, like people who aren't European can be dutiful citizens, but that you can't be an American citizen. So it sounds like newspeak, that people who are marginalized are, you know, supposed to be subordinate to them, quote unquote Europeans. And so we know what that's code for. That's code for bringing back, you know, the culture of the antebellum South. They clearly are people invested in white people being at the top, which is a white supremacist framework. And so I don't think that, I think that they are very clear about their beliefs, and they're not shying from those beliefs either.
And we're almost out of time. Abdumah Ali, did they say just racist things as they were marching through town, or were they more quiet in their?
They were chanting, but they were not saying overtly racist things. I mean, Reclaim America is, I think, a racist slogan. I don't know what they mean by that, but it sounds to me like it's racist. And they said, you know, the election was stolen, and they kept chanting that repeatedly. And we know that that's a dog whistle for white supremacist groups to claim that our democracy is under attack because of what happened during the last election. So I do think that they were saying things that were indicative of racism and white supremacy, but they didn't specifically say overt things that we would typically assign to white supremacists.
Well, we have to end it there. I hope you feel better, recover from your injuries. Abdumah Ali Muhammad, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And they are a Philadelphia-based activist, writer, documented the Patriot Front marching in Center City last Saturday. And as he, as they mentioned, was one of several targets of violence and retaliation. Well, coming up, what the heck is critical race theory that everyone is arguing about? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Until recently, critical race theory was a topic discussed in law schools and taught at colleges and universities. Now, this relatively obscure legal theory that racism is not just about individual prejudices, but embedded in the country's laws and institutions, has become a very public fight. Redlining is a good example of CRT. Republicans have made critical race theory a political punching bag. Here's Texas Senator Republican Ted Cruz.
Critical race theory is bigoted, it is a lie, and it is every bit as racist as the Klansmen in white sheets.
There have been contentious school board meetings with parents demanding that critical race theory not be taught to their children. And across the country, Republican lawmakers are working to pass bills banning or restricting how K through 12 teachers talk or teach about race. Well, we asked Mark Lamont Hill to join us. He's a professor of media, cities, and solutions at Temple University, the host of BNC's Black News Tonight. He's the founder and director of the People's Education Center here in Philadelphia, also the owner of Uncle Bobby's Coffee and Books, also here in Philadelphia. And Mark Lamont Hill joining us by Skype. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, so good to be here.
Nice to have you here with us. And let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation. Any questions or comments, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Mark, I watched a number of your interviews. You have interviewed a series of critical race theory critics, and you've asked them all a really basic question, which is, what is critical race theory? They cannot or they will not define it for you. Is that the problem in a nutshell? We don't know. We don't all agree what we're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, we're certainly having different conversations. The right wing strategy, and I think Christopher Rufo has actually articulated this quite honestly and plainly in some of his communications, including on Twitter, is to take any conversation about race, any conversation about history that is attempting to sort of reshape and challenge the dominant white supremacist narrative and to lump it all in under critical race theory so that any kind of race talk, any kind of justice talk will then be seen as critical race theory. And because there's such a anxiety around talking about justice or freedom or, you know, anti-colonialism, you know, identity, all of these things, it's very easy to create a public kind of outcry and even a moral panic against what they think is critical race theory, which is really just a movement for justice.
Well, and I do want to play actually part of your interview with Christopher Rufo, but let me just ask you, Mark Lamont Hill. So I put a small definition of critical race theory in my introduction. What is your definition? What is it we are talking about?
When scholars are talking about critical race theory, they're appealing to a body of scholarship that has emerged over the last three or four decades that started from a field called critical legal studies. Critical legal studies was attempting to simply sort of analyze the very, whatever we hear the word critical within the context of scholarship, it's referring to power and relations of power. And so critical legal studies was attempting to make sense of, you know, how power is wielded through the law, how different groups, different movements, different structures are advantaged by the law, and that we think the law is neutral, and it is in fact stacked in the interest of the powerful. And what critical race theorists said was, okay, we need to raise these questions about the law, but we can't do it in a way that is colorblind. In other words, we can't pretend that the law is colorblind. We have to look for laws that are facially neutral but have a different impact. We have to look at how our society, our systems, our institutions, our public policies are shaped by race and continue to shape our understanding of race. It was law school theory that has, you know, infiltrated schools of social work, schools of education, but graduate programs, you know, again, helping us theorize the relationship between race, law, and society.
Well, I mentioned redlining. I mean, I think there are many examples.
That's a great one.
I mean, does redlining feel like a good example where blacks were essentially kept out of neighborhoods? They couldn't get mortgages. And as we know, in this country, your home is your most valuable asset. And for African Americans, they were largely denied that.
That's exactly right. And the reason why that's such an extraordinary example is because it also communicates this idea of the facially neutral policy. Right. Redlining wasn't necessarily an explicitly anti-race policy, anti-black policy. I mean, another great example that I use with students, graduate students, is a grandfather clauses at the polls during Jim Crow that the law effectively said that anybody can vote. All Americans can vote as long as your grandfather voted. So the problem is, if you're in the 19th century and you're black, your grandfather was an enslaved person and therefore could not vote. And so while the law itself is facially neutral, on its face, there's no issue of race, there's no issue of classes. Anybody whose grandfather voted can vote. It ignores the fact that there is a differential impact based on race. And sometimes that impact is by design. People said, let's make this law so that black people can't vote. And then sometimes there are laws that aren't necessarily intended to more harshly punish black people, but have that consequence. For example, Rockefeller drug laws. although some would argue that it was always for that purpose. You could, if I give a generous read, I could say, okay, we're going to crack down on crack cocaine because it's vicious, it's killing everybody. And so there's harder penalties for crack cocaine than powder cocaine. Facially neutral, white people who smoke crack will get the same penalty. But the problem was, on the level of race and the level of class, we saw a differential impact. So critical race theory is helping us keep track of that stuff.
Well, let me play a clip, and this is you, Mark Lamont Hill. It's your interview with Christopher Rufo. He's a senior fellow with the Manhattan Institute and a leading opponent of critical race theory. He was a guest on your show on May 25th. This is about a minute. Let's play it, and then we'll talk about what he's saying.
Critical race theory, as it's practiced in institutions, as it's adopted in places like public schools, engages in practices that can only be described by any rational person as a form of state-sanctioned racism. In San Diego, they told teachers, quote, you are racist, you are upholding racist ideas simply because of the color of their skin. In Cupertino, California, for example, they separated third graders. These are 8- and 9-year-olds. They forced them to deconstruct their racial and sexual identities and then separated them into people who had power and privilege and people who did not. And finally, a place like even Springfield, Missouri, not exactly a blue city or a blue state, they told white male Christian teachers that by their inborn characteristics, they were inherently oppressors and had to atone for their covert white supremacy. Again, not judging people on their behavior, their character, their actions, their beliefs, just judging them on inborn characteristics, particularly race.
What he's saying there, Mark Lamont Hill, is that critical race theory is racism.
Right, right. It's such a fascinating approach. There's been a narrative, and ironically, critical race theory in some ways addresses this. But there is this idea that any race talk, any attempt to name race or to talk about race or to point out racial difference, is itself an act of racism. And so that leaves you in a very strange position. You have to become colorblind at all times. Now, some of the listeners will say, what's wrong with being colorblind? I'd say nothing. In and of itself, being colorblind could be great. You know, if I'm picking, you know, people for my softball team and I'm just picking people, I'm not going to say I'll decide based on race. If I'm deciding who won yesterday's national spelling bee, I don't think we should decide based on race.
We know who we would pick. Yes, I
exactly.
Got it.
But there are these moments where race does matter, because race has always mattered. And so we cannot pretend that race is not a central formative force of our nation. And so we have to take that seriously. We have to look at public policies that have advantaged certain races over others in terms of how we figure out how to fix it. There are all sorts of ways where we have to consider or at least talk about race. But for many people, even to mention race or racism, to even talk about what it means to be white or what it means to be black, is in and of itself an act of racism. And so what they want is what Micah Pollack calls color muteness. And so we're not only supposed to not see it, we're not supposed to talk about it. And that becomes a very, very tricky thing, particularly if you're on the wrong side of social injustice and social inequality. Because not only are you not getting access to social goods and resources, not only are you being mistreated, but when you try to name it or talk about it, they say you're racist for bringing up race.
Well, let me quote something else that he said. This is Christopher Rufo, and this is something he wrote recently in a conservative magazine. I'm not sure exactly which one it was. He's a member of the Manhattan Institute, which is a conservative think tank. I'm quoting from the Washington Post. He said, "We have successfully frozen their brand, critical race theory, into the public conversation and are steadily driving up negative perceptions. We will eventually turn it toxic as we put all of the various cultural insanities under that brand category. The goal is to have the public read something crazy in the newspaper and immediately think critical race theory." That's what they're doing. He has been successful. Yes.
Oh, he's been absolutely successful. And that's what I was talking about earlier in the interview, is that they've effectively lumped everything into critical race theory. And even though very little of it is, the Texas Public Policy Forum put out a tweet 2 weeks ago that I was able to screenshot. They quickly deleted it and denied me an interview for Black News Tonight. But they made a list of signs that critical race theory might be being taught in a classroom, and they were like, they gave a list of keywords, right? And the words were like, it was quite frankly stunning, the number of the type of words that were on the sheet. It was like, obviously, words like race, But it was also equity, diversity, inclusion, microaggressions, anti-racism, identity. They're saying that to say identity in a classroom is problematic. To say Black Lives Matter, to say reparation or liberation, to say normative, to say power structure, to say colonialism, to say cultural intelligence, to say privilege, to say culture, right? And so if everything is dangerous and everything is critical race theory, then effectively what they're trying to do is empty out our classrooms of any kind of potential for transformative change, any type of effort to make good citizens or to make an anti-racist society. For them is seen as an act of racism and an act of almost cultural insurrection. It's very, very dangerous.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I want to make sure our listeners can join our conversation. We are talking about critical race theory, what it is and what it isn't, how it has become politicized. And again, Mark Lamont Hill is our guest, professor of media, cities, and solutions at Temple University here in Philadelphia, the host of BNC's Black News Tonight, founder and director of the People's Education Center in Philadelphia. He's also got a bookstore in this town called Uncle Bobby's Coffee and Books. And you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I mean, we heard Rufo talk about various examples, you know, anecdotes of things that were done that I think a lot of people would feel uncomfortable with. So there are, I mean, when you sort of argue by anecdote, you can always find something to make your point. I don't understand how the supporters of critical race theory, how do you fight back? How do you push back?
I mean, part of what you have to do, and for me, you know, I wouldn't consider myself like the critical race theory advocate as much as someone who I find use and value in various theories, including critical race theory. And I'm certainly a proponent of allowing it to live and exist in the spaces that it has. I think the first thing we have to do, though, with regard to the right wing attack on it is to say, look, this is a solution in search of a problem. The idea that, you know, there's a bunch of kindergartners, you know, being taught to hate white people is just completely untrue. And even if we took away the kind of caricatures that they kind of apply to the narrative, and we were to just say, look, critical race theory in general is not being taught in school. There's no attempt to shape curriculum with critical race theory. All the movements and the school board protests and the people requesting in places like Florida, you know, that that body cameras be put on teachers so that, you know, to make sure no critical race theory gets taught. This is all ridiculous because no one is trying to. That's not in attempts. That's the first thing we have to do. The second thing we have to do is disconnect these outliers from the actual project of justice and the project of critical race theory. So when you see a teacher do something wild and crazy, when you see someone do something inappropriate, we have to point that out and say, yeah, this is problematic. This is troublesome. It also has nothing to do with critical race theory. But we also don't want to simply operate on their terms and play into their hands. You know, this idea, you know, one of the things Rufo talks about is this idea that critical race theory posits, you know, biological, one that makes race the sole determinant of success in America, or that the sole determinant of social goods and resources or how we should be or who we're going to be. Critical race theory doesn't make that argument. Critical race theory believes in critical race theorists, rather, because it's not a single critical race theory, but critical race theorists argue that things happen in intersections. Critical race theorists argue that there are multiple factors. Critical race theory doesn't say that just because you're black, you're going to turn out bad, or because you're white, you're going to turn out good. Critical race theory is examining these structures. And to be clear, critical race theory is not a biologically determinant theory. In other words, they're not saying that your biology, in this case, your race, is your destiny. It's simply saying that race plays a role in how you engage the world. Race plays a role in how the world engages you. Race is absolutely a social construct. No one is saying that race is some real biological thing. But the truth of it is still that despite that, it being a social construct, you know, race still matters. And race continues to matter in ways that it probably, we ideally shouldn't, in terms of whether you get a job or whether you get housing or health care or whether you can get a cab or whether your teacher thinks you're smart. I mean, these are things that race shouldn't matter, but they do. And pretending that it doesn't is not the way to fix it. And neither is the he who smelt it, dealt it approach that the right has, that if you point out racism, then you're the real racist because you said it.
I never heard it using quite that metaphor, Mark Lamont Hill. Let me read an email from Paul. He says, while critical race theory may be something to study on collegiate level, lower school educators who don't get proper instruction before teaching will turn it into an agenda to divide whites as privileged and people of color as victims. Just teach history as it happened, including any injustices. And I appreciate what Paul's saying there. And I, you know, as you said, this is a solution looking for a problem. I mean, why can't we just teach our history, warts and all?
Well, so there's critical race theory is really sort of disconnected from the teaching of history. That's a different conversation. You know, critical race theory is not rooted in that. But to be clear, I agree that we should be able to teach history, warts and all. But the problem is this idea that there is a singular history that we could all locate and then appeal to adjudicate competing claims about the world or competing visions about what actually happened is not true. History is always contested. History is always a battle. And I'll give you an example. To say that Lincoln freed the slaves and that the Civil War was fought to end slavery is a classic American narrative. Now, what we would say is, what critics would say is, well, you know, Lincoln was a little more thoughtful about this and nuanced in this. And he said that the purpose of this was to save the Union, that if he could have, you know, saved the Union and not ended slavery, he would have. Right. So that comes down to a critical race theory argument about interest convergence. Right. The idea that the powerful and particularly powerful institutions and states and governments, they don't just give things away, right? They shift their policies when their interests happen to converge with the interests of the people, right? That's why you get civil rights legislation. That's why you get Voting Rights Act. That's why you get public accommodations, and that's why you see an end to legal slavery in the United States. And so the teaching of history is cool. That's what we should do. But we have to have some sort of theory guiding it. We have to have some sort of analysis guiding it. And I'm not saying that critical race theory is the only game in town. But I'm saying that all of our history is guided by something. There's always a different narrative about how to think about history or how to tell a story. And I think that I think he's right that teachers have to be well equipped in whatever they're teaching. It's not just critical race theory. Sure. And again, first grade teachers aren't doing that. But if you don't understand the nuances of history, if you don't have a racial analysis and a class analysis and a gender analysis, right, then yeah, you'll talk about Pocahontas, you talk about who married Pocahontas or who married Sally Hemings, right? Not thinking about the ways that rape culture shapes how we understand relationships, right?
Mark,
those things weren't even possible.
Hold on, only because we have to take a very short break. We'll be right back after this short break talking with Mark Lamont Hill, Critical Race Theory. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about critical race theory. You've probably heard about it or read about it, talking about what it is, what it isn't, how it has been politicized. And Mark Lamont Hill is our guest, again, professor of media, cities, and solutions at Temple University, host of BNC's Black News Tonight. And again, to join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Mark, I want to read something that Lynn Chandler Garcia wrote in the Washington Post. She's a professor of political science at the U.S. Air Force Academy. She teaches critical race theory. She said, in my classes, cadets learn about the ideals embedded in this founding document, obviously the Constitution. We explore the liberalist theories that promoted these ideals, and we embrace our democratic system of government. But we also acknowledge that the United States was founded on a duality, liberalism and equal rights on the one hand, inequality and egalitarianism, and second-class citizenship on the other hand. Critical race theory provides an academic framework to understand these nuances and contradictions. It helps students identify the structural racism and inequality that has been endemic in American society, and it provides methods for deconstructing oppressive beliefs, policies, and practices to find solutions that will lead to justice. Does that square with what we're talking about?
I think it does. I think it gives us frameworks. I think it's right. We get frameworks, we get analysis, we get opportunities to question sort of the root causes of things, the logics that inform and shape our most treasured documents, our most treasured laws. I mean, that's what we need. And I think that, again, despite the kind of moral panic and the outcry when someone dares teaching that in an Air Force or dares teaching that in a law school or dares teaching that, you know, in a graduate course, I think that it's necessary among many theories. Again, critical race theory is not the only game in town, but it's necessary to have those types of frameworks, regardless of the theory for a moment. At some point, we're going to have to really question our foundation as a nation. We're going to have to question what shapes our ideas and what are the presuppositions and take in for granted logics that inform how we navigate the world. And I think, again, critical race theory is one of them, but we need a bunch of them.
I've said this before on the air, but when talking about how we deal with our racism and our racist history, and in some cases our racist present, I'm always reminded of a trip I took to Germany a couple of years ago and how that country has dealt with its Nazi past. They've got some current problems now, but how they have dealt with that with concentration camps where you can go and see the evidence of what was done to millions of people in that country. They have museums dedicated to understanding their history. They have removed their statues that honor, you know, members of the Nazi party. I mean, it seems that this is something that a country can do.
Absolutely. And when we think about the evils of the horrors and the evil of the Holocaust, when we think about, you know, Nazi Germany as being one of the most disturbing and disgusting, morally atrocious moments in human history, the question becomes, how do you come to terms with that? Well, you come to terms with it, as you pointed out, by being honest about it, first of all, but not denying it. Too often in the United States, we deny our history. We deny what happens. We sugarcoat it, right? I mean, as a settler colonial state, the United States likes to erase and plunder and destroy and remove. And so it's much easier. And this is what I was getting at when I was mentioning Pocahontas earlier, right? When we think about how those from our popular culture, you watch Disney Pocahontas to the history stories I got growing up in Philadelphia school district,
sure.
You know, you would think that, you know, she was courted, that there was a romance between her, right? And John, not just John Smith, but John Rolfe, right? You would think that there was, you know, agency and freedom, and that violence and sexual violence in particular wasn't the central part of the narrative. When we talk about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, for years we pretended that didn't happen, right? But when we finally did, we made it sound like it was a romance, as if someone who's enslaved has the ability to choose their romantic partner and that partner be their slaver. And so again, so we romanticize, we deny, we reject, we refuse to apologize as a nation, and we refuse to make whole. We refuse to repair the damage that's been done. Your example with Nazi Germany is a powerful one, because again, they don't, you know, the idea is we're not going to romanticize the evils of the Holocaust. We're going to tear down the statues that anything that would suggest anything other than shame for this moral atrocity. We're going to get rid of, because we should be ashamed, right? Think about what they do with the death penalty. I mean, think about, as a nation, Germany saying we don't have the moral authority as a nation that has killed so many of our innocents, as a nation that has done the greatest harm to the most vulnerable people, we don't have the moral authority to decide who lives or dies at the level of the criminal legal system, right? So they're making policy decisions, cultural decisions, the built environment, the material culture, the lived experiences of people are all a testament to this idea that we did an act of civic evil and we're going to be accountable for it so that we can be somebody else. The United States has not come to terms, and Germany's not perfect, but the United States hasn't even come to terms with that history in a significant fashion. We haven't come to terms with the fact that so much of the wealth that's been built, so many of the universities that we revere, so many of the banks and the insurance companies come from the exploitation of enslaved Africans. We don't want to account for it. We certainly haven't repaired the damage that's been done. We're just beginning to admit that people were slave owners. We're just beginning to take down some of the statues. We're just beginning to utter some semblance of an apology, and that's still not at the federal level. The United States is growing old, but it's not growing up when it comes to this idea of honesty.
Well, I do want to talk to you about the 1619 Project, just to add another element to our conversation. Just a couple of comments, questions from our listeners, from Dick. Wouldn't it be a good idea to denounce clearly the extreme practices that right-wing people use to criticize critical race theory, like lining up kids by race? I mean, there are incidents where you do hear in classrooms really, you know, things like that that actually do happen.
And again, without having full context of those incidents, I'm not going to start from the place of if you identify students by race, then that is inherently racist, right? To point out that students have different races or to organize them by race, to what end? Is this a demonstration of something? Is this, I don't know. My inclination as an instructor would be to say I would not do that, right? And I could see how it would be problematic to do that. I'm not endorsing that. But without full context, I don't want to just denounce it either, because I've seen too many misrepresentations out there of classroom practice. What I will say, though, is that the 1619 Project is an attempt to force America to have a moral reckoning and a political reckoning, to really be honest about the impact of slavery on the current moment, that this is not... That the enslaved Africans who were in Jamestown in 1619, and of course we can find, you know, slavery before 1619, but the people who were enslaved in Africa in 1619, excuse me, in the United States in 1619 in Jamestown, the impact of that of their lives and their experiences is still being felt today, and we have to be honest about that. And maybe the biggest way that we're not honest about that, one, is to pretend that slavery was a kind of interruption to an otherwise noble American democratic experiment, as opposed to seeing it as foundational to the American democratic experiment. And the other way that we do it is by pretending that race just doesn't matter. We keep acting like race does not matter. And Lord knows, in every way in these United States, race matters. But let me just say one more thing.
Sure.
Because there are people who would sit here and say, well, of course race matters. But the reason it matters is because you keep talking about it. If you just pretended that it didn't, let me not misrepresent their position. They would say that because we keep talking about it, we make it real. That if we were to just treat people by the color of their skin and not the content of their character, everything would be fine. And I say to them, well, that's easy to say if you're advantaged by the current system, right? If being white grants you greater access, or at least stops you from being you know beaten by the police or paying more for an insurance rate, or getting, you know, it stops you from getting, you know, higher interest rates, or it makes you being white makes you less likely to be suspended or expelled at school. If you're benefiting from this system, then it's very easy to say, well, let's just not talk about it. Let's just keep riding this white thing out. But there's also a way that you can't treat illness, and racism is an illness. It's an American sickness. We can't treat it by pretending it doesn't exist. It won't just go away. It's not a common cold. You know, it goes away with treatment. It goes away with healing. It goes away with intentionality. And we need it. I would love to live in a world where racism doesn't exist. I don't want to be post-race, because I don't want to live in a world where the only way you can see my humanity and love me and honor me is to not see that I'm black. I don't want to be colorblind. But I do want to live in a world that's not post-racial, but post-racist. I want to be in a world where my race isn't a social demerit, where being black doesn't stop me from getting the goods of society, doesn't stop you from seeing me as human. It allows us to be something different. And where better to train people for that kind of beautiful, humanistic, democratic citizenship than our schools? We have to do it right. And that doesn't mean we bring legal theory to school. It means that we bring honest, good conversation and good knowledge, proper vetted knowledge to classrooms, and we liberate our children, all of them, of every color, from these ideas of white supremacy and racism and homophobia and transphobia and sexism.
When you talk about white, I'm a privileged white woman with a job and a house and a family and all the privileges that have come from my lifestyle. But we also know that there are millions of white people in this country, you know, who are dying from deaths of despair. I mean, this is more about class than it is race. But it does, I think for a number of white people, if I can say that, this is not their experience. Their experience is not the kind of privileges that I have.
Right. And I think you're wise to point out that this is what you're pointing out in large is about class privilege, right? I mean, there are white people in West Virginia right now, or even in parts of Pennsylvania right now. Hell, there are white people right now in South Philly who look at me with a PhD and a fancy job and TV show and all this stuff and say, you're doing a hell of a lot better than me, buddy. And I would say you're absolutely right. You know, there's all of our social problems aren't reducible to race. And in fact, I would argue, you know, that we need a kind of an analysis of class that is our starting point. I'm saying that all of this racism, all of these antagonisms, all of these contradictions of race and gender and such, it only exists because we operate within a class-defending state. And so racism is, and all these other forms of injustice and inequality are simply the modalities and modes that play out because we live in the kind of capitalist world that we do. But all that said, I'll stipulate that, but just to answer that question directly.
Sure. And then I have a couple more comments. So
And I'll move quickly on this. I'll give a quick answer. But my quick answer is yes, being a poor white person sucks. And being a poor black person sucks. And we have to create mechanisms of justice that liberate all white people, to liberate all black people, but particularly that unite all poor people in a struggle to be free. But that doesn't mean that as a poor white person, whiteness doesn't play out in your life. It doesn't mean that, you know, as a poor white person, you still don't get privileges that I don't. Diva Pager wrote a book. She's since passed, but the great Diva Pager wrote a book called Marked. And she talked about how white men with a felony conviction have a greater chance of getting a job call back than black men without one. So, you know, that's how race matters. White people with the same drugs in their pocket don't get pulled over as much. They don't get stopped as much. They don't get arrested as much. They don't get the same sentences. They don't get the same jail sentences for what they do. And so race matters. And then finally, race. And this is what the great W.E.B. Du Bois talked about all the way back in 1935 in Black Reconstruction, and what honestly was a precursor to critical race theory, if not the foundational text. He asked the question about why white workers would side with slave owners instead of slaves, right? If you're a white worker, then it's in your interest to end slavery, right? Because as long as there's an enslaved person working for nothing, then you're never going to get a good wage. White people should be against slavery too. He said, why are they supporting the planter? Why are they supporting the bosses? He said, because they enjoy what he called the psychological wages of whiteness. They enjoy being white. They're closing ranks around their race and not around their economic condition. And so part of what critical race theory wants us to think about is how whiteness operates as property, how it operates as an ideology. It's the same reason why people vote for Donald Trump or George Bush, even though they're poor and white and vulnerable, and they're voting for wealth taxes that quite frankly benefit me more than them. They're voting for,
Mark,
for
gotta,
death taxes.
Yeah,
and
I got to jump in.
No,
it's okay. I've got a comment from Mike. He says, teaching critical race theory is unfair to my kids because it stereotypes them in school. Why don't we talk about how this stereotypes white kids? Does it?
But it doesn't stereotype. The idea here is not that all white people are the same. The idea here is that whiteness as an idea and as an identity comes with it certain realities in the United States, as do other realities and categories. If I were to say that women have a tougher time on the job than men, if I were to say that women make less on the dollar, that women have a glass ceiling in companies, I'm not stereotyping men. I'm not stereotyping women. I'm speaking to systemic problems. It doesn't mean there aren't exceptions. It doesn't mean there aren't good men who are fighting sexism. It doesn't mean that there aren't women who make, who may not deserve the raise or who may not deserve to be CEO of the company. Of course, these are all exceptions that we could point to. But at a systemic level, we live in a sexist society. We live in a patriarchal society. And me as a man, I have privileges and access that women don't. And I got to be honest about that. And I'm not being stereotyped as a man because I am being told that as a man, it'll be easier for me to get a job in TV. It'll be easier for me to get a late night show. It'll be easier for me to become a full professor. It'll be easier, you know what I mean, for me to be believed if I were sexually assaulted, right? These are just realities of what it means to live in a society shot through with all various forms of power, which is what critical is about. And so, no, it's not unfair to white kids to tell them that as white people, there are certain things in society that will benefit you. When I turn on the television as a white person, I can see a TV host that looks like me. When I turn on an NPR affiliate, most of the voices will sound like people who are of my race. And that's not to say all white people sound the same. I really just mean there are white people on the other side of the microphone.
Sure.
When I look at corporate CEOs, when I look at the presidency, white men were undefeated until 2008, right? I mean, there's a way that I can see myself in the world that black people can't. When I get a flesh-colored Band-Aid, it's going to look like my skin closer than a black person's. When all of these things are ways that whiteness is normative in society and blackness is seen as other. And we have to begin to challenge that world if we're going to create a world that is actually equal and free for everybody.
Well, we have to leave it there. Mark Lamont Hill, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And thank you for joining us as well. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.